From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Deucing in the consumer paradise of Dallas, Texas, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And joining us from his tent in the tent cities of Los Angeles, it's Eric Zaldivar once again joining us as our guest this week. Say hello, Eric.
Hoo-ah, everybody. Hoo-ah.
Hoo-ah. Hey, if I was 10 years younger, I'd take a, what does he say, like a chainsaw to this place.
Sin of a Woman, forgotten, acclaimed movie from its day.
Yeah, somewhat over-acclaimed, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
Big time. From the director of Beverly Hills Cop, Martin Brest.
That's right.
never seen it.
I think that was the first movie. That was, yeah, it's, you know, it's,
oh, I have no interest.
It's worth seeing just to see where the Pacino meme comes from. Cause everybody who's doing a Pacino impression is doing that movie.
Was that the first time? It couldn't have possibly been. Was he already a caricature at that point?
I think that's the movie where it crystallized.
Yeah.
Where,
okay.
Where it was like, it was all there, you know, he's going, hoo-ah.
Yeah, he got acclaimed for it, and he was constantly requoted. And I mean, it was a comedian meme before it was even a meme. You know, Before there were memes.
What was first, that or Heat? Because he was pretty he was pretty Al Pacino by then.
Yeah,
I think Heat was after that.
Okay.
Where he just seems to be improvising. Yeah, he was just improvising in Heat half the time. It seemed
Heat
like.
Was after Scent of a Woman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was early 90s, Al, you know, because Godfather Part 3 was 2 years before that, Sin of a Woman. It was 1990. Sin of a Woman was 92.
That's when he started wearing that wig that looks like my COVID hair.
Well, Al Pacino wears a lot of wigs in the movie we're talking about today. It's Phil Spector, written and directed by David Mamet. And starring Al Pacino as the title character, Phil Spector, the title real-life character, may he rest in peace, who died recently in prison. You have Helen Mirren. You've got Jeffrey Tambor.
Rest in prison.
Rest in prison. you filthy animal. And it's actually produced by Barry Levinson, and it's part of a series of movies Levinson did for HBO where Al plays kind of controversial figures. There's one where he plays Jack Kevorkian called You Don't Know Jack, and then there's one where he plays Joe Paterno. But I think Levinson directed the other two. But he produced.
Yeah, luckily he didn't direct this one.
Yeah, I agree. Barry Levinson's done like two movies I like, and everything else I've seen by him is just yeah. But you know, this movie, Phil Spector, it was done for HBO, and it was about his trial. And what's kind of it was kind of controversial when it came out because it was basically a Phil Spector's not guilty movie, you know, and Phil Spector's guilt was something I think everybody agreed on, you know, but
well, what's made the odder is that Mamet didn't even believe that he was innocent. So he's like basically trolling the audience.
Interesting. So you think
not only did I read, and I didn't do like deep research. This is Wikipedia. And he said he was quoted in an interview that outside of the music, he didn't know much about him. And when he decided to do the movie, he knew he was guilty, but decided to portray him as an innocent man or something. He was bizarre.
Well, I have another.
Well, you have to keep in mind it depicts the mock trial.
Yes, it's not. It doesn't depict the actual. You have like one day in court. That they build up to, but I remember reading a piece in the LA Times and I found it here. It says, "Never mind that the jury sent him to prison for murder in the second degree. Phil Spector's not guilty, says writer David Mamet. Quote, I don't think he's guilty. I definitely think there's reasonable doubt, end quote, he told the Financial Times.
Okay, well, I read something else then.
Well, no, I read the thing you said on Wikipedia, but I remembered reading a piece where Mamet was like, he's not guilty. So he said, whether he did it or not, we'll never know. But if he'd just been a regular citizen, they never would have indicted him, is what Mamet said. He said they, and.
Yeah, right.
But, you know,
Mamet's full of shit.
He's done a few things like this, where he's done movies about people who were accused of a crime, who are guilty or not guilty, or books. He's done a few of these in the past, so there's kind of a precedent for him exploring topics like this. But I guess let's start a little bit with Phil Spector himself. I mean, the guy, to me, I always thought of him as this really influential producer from like a bygone era, you know, like the 60s, you know, doing stuff like the Ronettes and the Righteous Brothers and the Beatles and John Lennon and George Harrison and the Ramones, just what I, you know,
the Ramones.
Yes. And I just, you know, but I'd always heard stories about him shooting off guns and basically acting like a crazy person. But then, you know, he was accused of murder. And I remember it was during Obama's run for president. Spector was in the courtroom with like an afro and like an Obama for president button on.
Great endorsement.
Yeah, it just seemed like such a mess, this trial. And then he went to prison, and you know, the other day he died in prison. I think he was up for parole in 2024. But this film focuses on the prep for the trial. Helen Mirren stars as his lawyer, and Jeffrey Tambor plays one of the lawyers. They're like a team of lawyers who are getting him ready. But you know, I know, you know, we kind of started off kind of talking about the Al Pacino meme. I'm hearing myself come back on the.
So am I.
Yeah.
You guys hearing it too?
Yeah.
Okay.
I
don't hear it anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, not hearing it now.
One second. Okay, 10. I just got to write that down. You know, we have the Al Pacino meme where he's like a caricature of himself. But when he comes
don't
out
you,
in this, go, what was
mean,
that? What was that, Eric?
Don't you mean Dunk?
Dunk. It's not Al. It's Dunk. We do that in my film class all the time. We'll go, it's not Al. It's Dunk. you know, when we meet him in this movie, you know, you were talking about that Mamet interview, Eric. He's supposed to be like the Minotaur in this maze. They bring him up like he's this freak in this maze. And Helen Mirren goes to his house, and his house is this bizarre place. It's full of images of Abe Lincoln and Lenny Bruce and John Lennon and, you know, T.E. Lawrence and all these people. And, you know, Al Pacino comes out and he gives like a 20-minute monologue.
Yeah.
But I thought Al kind of gave a real performance in this movie where he seemed more manic. He didn't seem, I mean, he's Al Pacino, but he doesn't seem as, you know, he's given a few real performances in his later years, and I think this is one of them. I don't know. What did you guys think?
I kind of feel like the character was better for his new unique style of overacting that he does in his scene chewing.
Yeah.
Like, I think Phil Spector is just more suited to his newfound personality, that he's getting more fame for how he acts now than how he was in Serpico and The Godfather. It's really strange. Or Dog Day
Afternoon. He was very soft spoken in those movies.
Right. Yeah. It's a very different actor. And this is just simply better suited for him. And I also wonder, are these HBO movies, I don't see most of them, but it seems to be like they're just opportunities for these big name actors to ham it up. And because you had Michael Douglas playing Liberace in one movie or something with Matt Damon as his boyfriend.
Listen, I want you to get plastic surgery and look like
yeah, what a
me
weird,
so I can have
what
sex
a weird
with
choice.
You.
Yeah, what a weird choice.
Anybody seen the Andrew Robinson Liberace movie?
No.
I think it's a TV.
No.
He's really good in it.
I haven't seen it. I think that aired on ABC or one of the networks or something, and it did get a lot of acclaim.
Yeah, it was on YouTube years ago, and I was very around the time that the Michael Douglas one came out, and I was pretty impressed by it. It was way better than the Michael Douglas one. He was really good in it in terms of performance. But yeah, sure. Like John said, Pacino here is fine because he's playing already a pretty cartoonish character to begin with. So it's sort of his persona post Scent of a Woman has, it finds itself where it needs to be as opposed to being distracting. When do you think Pacino is a smoker and or drinker and or both?
Yes.
Because, yes, he was. Spoken in those early films, and then
both
somewhere, I don't know when, in the 80s sometime, you started getting that croaky.
I remember my dad goes, he said, like, you look at Pacino in the 70s, and then you look at him, like, he seemed to age really fast. And he was like, he goes, I think that's a good example of what that stuff will do to you. Because he seemed to go from, like, 30s to 60s almost overnight.
You're not a friend? You're not a brother? To, hey, let's go.
He was, hey, I'm Al Pacino. You know, what am I going to do?
And then Big he's Daddy's like, here.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, he seemed to age very rapidly. And, 80s Al Pacino, it seemed like it seemed like he aged a decade between Scarface and Carlito's Way.
Yeah, or even, God, I've never seen it, but there's that movie Sea of Love.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's when I've been wanting to check it out because it was, it's from a time when adult thrillers were coming from studios and played in a lot of theaters, which I can't even imagine now. Yeah. In fact, that Denzel movie that's on HBO Max and it's in theaters right now, and it's getting a lot of bad reviews and bad word of mouth.
Oh, yeah, it's got Jared Leto. It's the like a Seven things. Ripoff.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it's like it's getting bad word of mouth, but I was kind of reminded of back when a movie like that would have been typical to come out at least once or twice a month.
Oh, it would have been like Along Came a Spider or Kiss the Girls or Double Jeopardy. Or,
what's the one with David Caruso that was like a remake? It's Kiss of Death or something like that.
Session 9. No, I'm kidding.
No, it was very loose. It had Nicolas Cage as the bad guy, and he looked like he'd been doing roids, and he had like a goatee, and they kill Michael Rapaport to like
that's because
pain music.
I was getting ready for Superman, okay? So I had to
steroids. He wasn't acting like that. He was like just speaking in a low voice and being intimidating, like, I don't like metal in my mouth, or something like that. It was real. What the hell is that film called? Oh, man. Now I'm going to IMDb.
You got it right the first time. Kiss of Death.
1995. Yeah, that weird thing. But stuff like that was out every month. I mean, or every couple of weeks, you got an adult thriller that this is not for kids. This is for adults. This is for grown men to go see in the movies.
Basic Instinct.
Yeah, so I do want to see Sea of Love eventually. Maybe it'll pop up on the streams just because I mention it, and there's some curse with that, but we'll see.
Those things were still popping up in the early 2000s. There's the Michael Douglas one with Brittany Murphy where she's in the insane asylum. I forget the name of it now.
Which you'll never know. Yeah,
that was written by Andrew Klavan.
Really?
Yes.
The great conservative Andrew Klavan.
Yes, the guy who used to do all those like explainer videos for Breitbart.
Oh, God. Yeah, you'll never see his credit on a mainstream movie again.
I miss Brittany Murphy. You know.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. I saw her in set Chop Saki movie, straight to video Chop Saki movie from 97.
Drive.
Yeah, I saw her in recent.
Oh, actually, that was a straight to HBO movie.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. It premiered on HBO. It was back when HBO.
Isn't MVD putting that out or something? Doesn't that?
Yeah, they are. They're putting it out, and I guess they're going to offer both Steve Wang's director's cut, and then they're going to offer the HBO cut.
Mm.
And the director's cut's never been released legit on US DVD, so it'll be interesting.
Yeah, that's a purchase for me.
Yeah, the movie's fun. It's a lot of fun. She's good in it, too.
And it's got Mark the God Tacascos, right?
Oh, yeah, Mark Tacascos. It's got a fight scene in it that was completely plagiarized by Blade 2.
Sweet.
Yeah.
You'll like spot Blade 2,
when
so,
you watch it.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good movie. Del Toro actually told Steve, like, oh, yeah, we had a copy of Drive on the set. We were studying it to do a fight scene.
Oh, yeah, we were watching Drive. It was very good.
We were watching it. I'm a creative genius, but we were watching your fight scene.
And I said to Wesley and Norman, I said, let us recreate this fight scene. Don't you think it would be good?
And Wesley Snipes,
yes,
he said to me, hey, man. You know, if you spend the money before you pay the IRS, you don't have to pay them off. Trust me.
Del Toro thought it was the most, it was more depressing than when his father was kidnapped.
Yes, yes. Oh, it was worse when Harvey cut my movie than when my father was kidnapped and burned alive in an oil barrel in Central America.
It was worse.
It was worse.
That guy's coffee tastes bad that morning. At first, Dad, he didn't give a shit about his dad.
Anything that happens to me is worse than anything.
I didn't know that about Del Toro.
My insulin shot. It's worse than my dad getting kidnapped.
Yeah, he said that Harvey Weinstein recutting Mimic was more traumatic for him than when his father was kidnapped.
Oh, my. What a fucking reptile. Fuck him. That's his shit.
His RC giant cockroach rapist movie. Stupid.
Jesus.
Fucking retard.
Oh, man.
Of course he was going to win an Oscar in 20 years.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, man. But, you know, is Phil Spector, like, what, as a producer, you know, what are you, is he like a guy that you have for particular fondness for, or do you care, or, you know, how does he enter into your pantheon of pop music? Are you like Can't Bot John, where you're like, oh, these, the great, you know, just genius, or? What are your thoughts on it?
Okay. Phil Spector is sort of defines the 60s AM radio rock sound, rock soul sound for me. So, you know, I think he struck a great idea at the time. I think that music still sounds great. I can still listen to it and not feel bad about what he did later in life. But I don't like the Ramones album that he produced.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, and... back then, Johnny Ramone said Phil Spector pointed a gun to his head and said, "You're not leaving this studio," or whatever. And Johnny Ramone walked that right out.
He was like, "What are you gonna do? Kill me?
Screw you?
What are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? Like, shoot me? I'm leaving."
Yeah, and Johnny Ramone said back then, a man like that should not own guns.
And this is right wing,
you know, in terms of conservative, you know,
yeah, this
NRA,
is right-wing.
Everything. And he said Phil Spector should not own firearms.
Yeah, yeah. They took all my guns away.
Because he's the type that, he pulls the guns out and he waves them around at people and shit. I think that's exactly what Johnny Ramone was talking about. And it's just, that's not a responsible human being who should be owning guns.
You know, I don't think he should be owning guns. You know, I think he's a pig.
He shouldn't own guns. That's wrong.
You know?
And by the end of the century recordings, Joey Ramone was the only one working on the album. Everybody else had left. They couldn't stand Phil Spector.
Yeah, and I saw this. When Phil Spector died, I posted this interview where the Ramones were talking about working with him. And Johnny and Dee Dee were the only ones talking, and Joey Ramone is stone silent, like not saying anything. And, you know, and typically the policy of the band was don't let Joey talk because he's nuts. And he's OCD, and, you know, he's going to do something stupid. But you could tell Joey Ramone felt very differently about that record than everybody else.
Yeah, he always said he wanted to work with him again. And and a lot of people complain about how Spector produced the Beatles, Let It Be. You know, there's always been a lot of complaints about that.
I was proven right!
But I can at least say that, I mean, I can go back and listen to the Ronettes or the Crystals or whoever else he produced, the Righteous Brothers, any day. I can listen to that stuff anytime.
The Ronettes, I listen to the Ronettes' greatest hits all the time. So good.
It's fantastic. And the truth is, it's like that stuff was designed that way to sound good on AM radio. Mm-hmm. So if you sounded good on AM radio, you're going to sound good in any format. You're going to sound terrific because that's what the Wall of Sound was all about. Because AM radio had that tinny, boy, it barely exists these days, I think, for a lot of young people. But it had that weak sound for music that you don't know how anybody enjoyed tunes on there. But the Wall of Sound production quality was really good at, you know, bringing some power to AM radio.
You know, they said that the Jews created the music business. No. I created the music business, all right? Some guy wearing a yarmulke, hunched over a desk, he didn't create the music business. I created the music business.
Yeah, it's just like, but I love I do love, like, old Phil Spector productions. It's separate the art from the artist, this, that usual thing. So, I mean, he was a psychopath.
Yeah, I love listening to that old stuff, you know, like the Righteous Brothers. It just sounds so good. The Ronettes, you know, just it's amazing. I know a lot of there's divided opinions on the Beatles stuff. I was kind of underwhelmed by Paul's stripping out the Phil Spector production.
Yeah, naked isn't much better.
Yeah, I wasn't impressed. I was not impressed with being naked.
Yeah. But you know, I think with the Ramones, I mean that's kind of the last thing he did that anybody cared about, right? And that's on a very small level because the Ramones were not a big selling band,
you know, because I don't know what he was doing since the Ramones, but you know, he was always in the news for kind of being a nut. I love, there's that scene in the movie where they watch the old footage of him in the studio and he's giving an interview and he starts firing the gun off in the studio. And when I was watching it, my wife turned to me and she goes, "The fine arts is the only industry where they tolerate this stuff."
That's true.
She goes, "People
it's
go
the only place where a guy like John Landis will still work."
Yeah, where they go, "Ooh, he's interesting and kooky," you know. But she was like, "This is the only place where they put up with this nonsense."
It's very true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, he couldn't work as a police officer and do that shit.
No. Oh. Especially today.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But, yeah, there's a lot of kind of diving back into Phil, but the theme of this movie is kind of, you know, like you said, Eric, we're going to try to make you sympathize with this monster character. And I do think in the film it's interesting to explore the idea of the weirdo celebrity who is kind of convicted because he's a weirdo. You know, you go, well, of course he did it. You know, I think that's an interesting idea, even if I'm like, well, yeah, he did it. what were some of your takeaways from that, like with the theme of it, Eric?
Full disclosure. All right. I don't know what's going on. I'm dehydrated or something. I'm not feeling too myself. And I saw this, I think it was for the recording of The Family, the Charles Bronson movie, Violent City.
Oh, yeah.
So this is 6 months ago. I saw it immediately after that because we discussed the movie. And for whatever reason, I thought that we were going to watch the film a week from then or something. So I watched the film. I didn't think too much about it, to be honest with you. And my interest in Phil Spector isn't much. I'm going to be a terrible guest today. Outside of the music he made, I grew up on that music. So, you know, to me, he did all right. As far as the man is concerned, I don't know too much about him. I don't think the movie gave me any insight on it either. Really. That's basically my piece. I thought it was a pretty average piece of work. I didn't think too much about it.
You are a terrible guest, Eric. I'm very disappointed.
Well, it's It's basically a TV movie.
Yeah,
and it's only elevated by the fact that David Mamet's name is on the credits, and I don't even know if that means anything much these days. That would have been a big deal.
This is the last thing he's done too. This is his
newest thing. and this bigger name. You know, you didn't have big names like Helen Mirren and Al Pacino doing TV movies 30 years ago, and now you've got them doing HBO movies. But it's very cheap. I think that's why they emphasize the mock trial, because it certainly costs less to produce that stuff than to actually show the real trial.
A lot of the film, the most elaborate thing is the stuff at Spector's house. Everything else is kind of in the office. We sort of see I thought it was kind of interesting to sort of see the office grow, you know, where they have the lawyers working. It starts out at some tables, some pictures, some stuff, and it eventually gets more and more. There's more and more stuff on the wall related to the case. I thought that was interesting, and it felt theatrical. It felt like, because Mamet comes from theater.
It felt like a play. Actually felt like a play. It could be produced as a play pretty easily.
My wife has done a lot of theater, and when we were watching it, she was going, man, you know, there's a lot of long scenes where Pacino just goes on and on and on, where he is just, you know, going on these stream of consciousness things. I love the scene where he is introduced.
Yeah.
Because he just goes on all these stream of consciousness tangents about stuff from the Civil War, T.E. Lawrence, Abraham Lincoln. And then Helen Mirren will go, did you shoot that girl in the face? And he'll go, well, let me tell you about Lincoln when he freed the slaves. and then she'll go, did you shoot that girl? And he'll go, well, listen, T.E. Lawrence was an S&M freak, but also a...
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, it's like his performance, for as crazy as it is, it's not over the top enough for this to be seen as camp.
No.
Or like something unintentionally funny. The odd thing was, like, they show, like, they're looking at the Lana Clarkson demo reel she did as her career was pretty much ending.
Where she's like in blackface.
She tried to make a comeback as a comedic performer. And I was looking at that tape, and she made a real tape like that. You can find the footage of her as Little Richard on YouTube. And to me, that came off like something. She was unmarried at 40, still wanting to be in showbiz. And I'm thinking that's probably what a gay manager told her to make. Telling her the real business. Hey, look, you should just retire for the bit. Go marry a real estate guy. Derek and I have been talking about how these beautiful women you'll see in 80s movies, they end up marrying real estate.
Yeah, absolutely.
In California, and just, you know, having kids, and they're done. You know, they're finished with their careers. They don't care about the movie business anymore. And she was the perfect example of somebody not willing to accept that fate, and unfortunately ending up at Phil Spector's house. And the actress they had playing her in the reenactments didn't look as good as she did. I guess you can't find that perfect blonde, you know, Amazon blonde that she was, you know, anywhere in Hollywood today. But the reenactments and stuff, I think, made it look stupider than it really was.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, it's just like, but like I said, I think it's something that a gay manager said, oh, you should put a blackface and do Little Richard and be a comedian. Just to keep her on as a client for whatever reason.
Right. You know, probably was desperate enough to pay those bills.
Yeah, it's very cringe. It's like, but you know how things run in Hollywood. You have agents or managers not telling them what they need to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not realistic about her career, and it's unfortunate.
Do you know why she was killed, John? I'm going to tell you.
I only know, like, the semblance of Spector shooting her or whatever. I think he was waving his gun around, and then he had her, like, fillet the gun or something. I don't know. I didn't even read up on it. I didn't care.
Well, she was in John Landis's Amazon Women on the Moon, so that's why
Okay. Wow, you work with Landis, you're dead.
Yeah, just, you know, just kills you.
But she was somebody who should have been, like, I guess she should have gone for the Sybil Danning type of thing.
When there's not a room. Later on.
Yeah, it's just like, but there's no, you know, Sybil Danning had to pretty much end her acting career, what, 1991, 92?
Mm-hmm.
She quit appearing.
She's the only one that didn't marry a real estate agent.
Yeah.
And the modern day equivalent of that is they just marry billionaires now.
Yeah. Speaking of, there's a meme about that I need to send you.
National corporate execs.
But yeah, because I don't know much about her. You know, I just know her as this sort of B-movie actress that was killed by Phil Spector. Allegedly. No, I'm just kidding. He was found guilty, so we can say it was real. speaking of... speaking of women rich guys marry, I just sent you guys a meme that is pretty good about that on Facebook.
Okay.
My favorite line from this movie is when Al's Phil goes, "Freud was a confidence man. Just invented a disease instead of a cure." But one thing in this movie is the back to mono. Was that a thing? Do you guys remember that back to mono? Was that real? I need to look that up. Back to mono, Phil.
There was a box set called Back to Mono.
Oh, really?
A box set 58 to 69. I guess it's a compilation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a great box set. It's a great box set.
Wow, it's got a lot of stuff on there. The crystals, Benny King.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's back when box sets were amazing, you know.
Hmm.
Over 2 hours long, AllMusic gives it 5 out of 5 stars.
Mm. You've lost that love and feeling, Unchained Melody. This movie opens with Unchained Melody with Lana Clarkson getting in the car to go to his house. That's the opening. Yeah. That's the little opening of the film. And I was watching it with my wife and my mother-in-law, and they were kind of going, "What's going on during these credits?" And I was like, "Hold on, that's just wait." but did you guys feel like this movie was, because it's sort of how can I put it, like this movie does feel like a Phil Spector was innocent type movie. Did it make you reconsider anything, or did you kind of look at it and go, "Yeah, you know, dude was nuts"? Or look at it at a different angle.
All you ever heard about.
That son of a bitch killed Barbarian Queen. I know he did.
Probably on accident.
Yeah, because we've heard a lot of stories.
He was being a hot shot. Yeah. Waving his gun around.
I think he was probably doing his usual thing and probably killed her by accident, is what I think.
Yeah. I mean, the odds were, you know, he had been doing that his entire life. At some point, something's going to go bad.
Right. You know, if you treat a gun as a toy, any gun expert will tell you that it eventually is going to not go so well. You know, they do all this stuff with, like, how the blood would come out of the mouth and how, you know, they do all these recreations of the how the blood would splatter and all that. But if guns are one of those things that are so unpredictable, I don't think you can model something like that and have it be set in stone going,
"No,
this is, you know what? We just showed this model, and this guy pointed the gun in the mouth, and the blood got all..." Because one of the things is he didn't have any blood on his outfit, right? Or just a little bit.
Right.
And in the movie, they do this model where if you stick your gun in someone's mouth and you shoot him, like, all his blood, like, comes geysering out. But bullets are something that are wildly unpredictable. If you've ever shot guns with any regularity, bullets do all kinds of crazy stuff. You just, you know, if you really look into the JFK assassination, you know, the magic bullet thing, well, that's just bullets being freaking weird, you know? and so, you know, you can't
predictable.
Do that.
You never know. Yeah, it's just, yeah. Yeah, bullets are like, they're never 100% going to do the same thing every time. That's just the truth about guns. It's different calibers, different... I mean, it's just, it's impossible to say, oh, the bullet wouldn't do this and wouldn't do this to the human body or whatever. It doesn't make any sense. It's like, you can't even say that stuff. What you saw was a desperate defense team, basically well paid, very well paid by Phil Spector, trying to come up with the most desperate gotcha theory to say, hey, look, he didn't kill her or whatever. That's all you see.
Look at any like gun nut forum, and there'll inevitably be a discussion about 25 ACP, and you know, there'll be an entire thread of people saying that, mostly people who've never even fired a 25 ACP because they have such a prejudice against them. But then there will be always that one guy that, you know, like everybody will say, ah, it doesn't even pierce the skin at times, but there'll always be that one guy where it's just like, nah, 25 ACP, I've seen that go through skin and ricochet all over the body and actually do more damage than something higher caliber, just because it just makes mincemeat of your organs because it's ricocheting all over your ribs and things.
Yeah, absolutely. So the argument that this movie makes, I think, is kind of weak. That, you know, because he didn't, you know, he wasn't covered in blood.
But will that hold up in court, though? It might.
It might. Well, that's the thing. One of the things in this movie is it's about casting the reasonable doubt. Okay? And so one of the things in this movie is there a reasonable doubt? Well, this kind of casts that. And so they want that. It's all about how in court you do the creative argument to try to convince the jury. Convince the jury. Yeah. And one thing in the film is they have this mock trial because Phil wants to go on the stand and tell everybody what happened. But they're like, they want to tell him that's a bad idea because he's a freak, you know?
Right.
And
he's Phil Spector.
Yeah, exactly. Because he is who he is. And he's going to get up there and the prosecution is going to make him look like an insane person. And so during this mock trial, Chiwetel Ejiofor plays who was the star of David Mamet's Red Belt, plays the mock prosecutor, and he basically gets Phil to crack on the stand, and they can basically convince him that this is a bad idea to get up there because he can't keep it together because he's gonna pop off, he's gonna go crazy, and that is what. That's kind of what we see in the film, though. The film kind of does cast a little bit of doubt. Pacino, anytime he talks about the girl committing suicide, he hesitates. He's like, this girl, she killed herself in my house. He stops. And when he's during that mock trial, he just goes bananas, you know, and that, and it's very convincing. I mean, I really like Pacino's performance in this. I the first time I saw this film, I saw it a few years ago, and I did, like you guys, I didn't think much of it. Mm-hmm. But this time I liked it a lot more on the second viewing. I went, wow, this is... I actually think a lot of the performances are really nuanced and in-depth, and there's a lot of themes here with, you know, the Minotaur and, like, the idea of perceptions of reality with guilt and innocence. I think there's a lot to chew on with this movie. I don't know, but I don't get the feeling you guys were as hot on it.
Well, knowing what I know about Phil Spector, like in Keith Richards' autobiography, he talked about he had an affair with Ronnie Spector while Phil was beating her and married to her, and I think Keith was nailing her and stuff. Phil Spector is a pretty nasty. I think he was always a nasty piece.
And
for this movie to try to present any sort of Phil Spector trutherism, it doesn't really succeed because it's pretty obvious that Phil Spector is a psychopath. So, and always had problems. And I mean, if you think about it, people didn't work with him after the Ramones, you know, simply because nobody wanted to work with this asshole. He was impossible to work with.
Yes.
And it's just like nobody wanted to put up with the guns and shit. They didn't care about his previous rep. And it's like he's one of those that phase of the industry had passed him by.
Mm-hmm.
And he's living off the royalties for Back to Mono and all that stuff getting played on the radio and in movies all the time. You know, Dirty Dancing probably paid the castle's tax bill
you know, throughout the 80s. You know, the problem with the movie is it's not, it's a TV movie, so it can be very small scale and be somewhat workable. It has these big name actors in it and everything, but it doesn't have that structure where you're like, whoa, this is a really good payoff and everything, because we already know what happened. We saw this in the media, and that works against it. And that's a problem I have with anything that reenacts something that's happened in the last 20 years, where we have 24/7 cable TV and court TV and whatever, you know. It just doesn't really hit on any like high art level, or even for a David Mamet movie, it just doesn't. There's almost like no reason he needed to direct this. Anybody else could have made this movie, and it would have been the same, you know.
Which
the Mamet dialogue isn't really solid either. It's not really that heavy. It's not his usual pacing with the dialogue and stuff. But yeah, Pacino's good. I mean, I actually like Pacino's performance in it. I didn't have a problem with that. It's a highlight.
It needed more wig.
Yes.
I mean, to have that wig be the payoff. Like, he shows up in court that day. She knows it's screwed up already.
And I love how he insists it's his real hair. He's like...
Yeah. But I like the scenes of him freaking out over the Ronnie Spector video and stuff. And the actress they had playing Ronnie Spector looked a lot like the, you know, the... Double O, the Ronnie Spector of the Double O's.
Oh yeah, he's talking about. He was. She saw that video. He's like, "Get that bitch off of here!" Who put it up here?
Yeah. I used to be a nut for rock trivia of the 60s and 70s. So it's like that was pretty funny and amusing. And so, you know, I thought that was well done.
Yeah. Yeah, I like a lot of the video segments where we flashback, like him in the studio talking about how Freud is a confidence man.
Yeah, actually, that was where Pacino to me looked the most like Phil Spector, because it looked like the old films I've seen of Spector, you know, producing in the studio. And I guess that's supposed to be the Wrecking Crew he's yelling at and waving the gun around too.
That's what it looked like. Why do you need so many guns? How many pairs of shoes do you have? I was like, hey, that's a good point.
You should never ask a woman her age, and you should never ask a man, why do you have so many guns?
Yeah.
That's a good argument.
Yeah. No, I remember when we were watching it, my wife goes, that's a good point. Yeah. Why do you need so many guns? Why do you have so many shoes?
Yeah.
What do you need that many shoes for? You can walk just fine.
One day you want to shoot the Charger Arms, the next day you want to shoot the Smith & Wesson. It's just, you know,
yeah,
it's a mood.
Exactly. It all depends on my mood, what gun I use. Uh-huh.
Right.
I invented the music industry.
Yeah, but it just doesn't feel like a real movie. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, I agree.
That was my issue when I saw it. And on top, it felt disingenuous when I saw it and I didn't know the background information. And then when I found out that Mamet basically didn't even believe he was innocent, I was just like, well, there you are. And it was stagey. And I don't know, maybe I'm doing it a disservice because Hunter seemed to like it on the second viewing.
So. I did. I liked it more the second time than I did the first. The first time I thought, okay, it's kind of interesting, but I quickly forgot about it. But when he died, I thought it would be interesting to revisit it. And I liked it a lot more the second time. But like you guys said, it is stagey. It has a lot of scenes that go on for a long time. And I also think the idea is interesting of a lawyer defending the indefensible. There's that that woman that comes up to Helen Mirren. It's like, how could you possibly defend that man? And she, you know, it kind of gets down to the idea of being entitled to a defense in America when the court of public opinion has already deemed you guilty. I think that's a big thing, especially I think that theme resonated a lot more with me in 2021 than it did when I first watched it, because we so much live in a kangaroo court society right now where everybody just goes, well, that you're obviously guilty, goodbye, you're canceled. And I'm not saying Phil, and that is not me saying Phil Spector is innocent,
But it's you definitely saying Marilyn Manson.
It's me saying Marilyn Manson did nothing wrong. No, I'm kidding. No. Oh, man. Marilyn Manson's one of those guys, when you listen to... Let's talk about Manson for a second. When I would hear interviews with him, I would always hear drugs and alcohol talking. Seriously, especially in the past 15 years. I think he could keep it together a lot better in the 90s when he would give interviews. But when I heard him on Bret Easton Ellis, I was like, this guy is a drug addict maniac. When I heard him talking, I was going, this guy's he is bad news. He's a bad hombre.
He is pretty poofy nowadays, which might be age, but it also might be alcoholism.
Yeah, he was in that show, The New Pope. That HBO show, there's that scene where he meets with John Malkovich's Pope. He was looking puffy. He looked like, you know, his face was swollen in that scene.
Yeah. He looked like
he looked will age your fucking ass so quick before you can even blink. If you're head, down in vodka every day and all that shit he was doing.
His head looked like a 75-year-old Fred Williamson's hand.
But no, Manson's one of those guys, you know, in the 90s, he was the Alice Cooper of the 90s. He was kind of this boogeyman figure. But now he's almost quaint, you know.
There's an innocence to all that stuff now.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
He was the shock rock backlash to Grunt.
Yeah.
Like on FM radio. Like he got played on FM radio pretty aggressively.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost like we were tired of the grunge and, oh, here's this guy with a real bouncing, heavy kind of Alice Cooper type thing going.
What was it? AJ Benza was talking about. I saw him and Nine Inch Nails at the Garden and, you know, you'd be going to get a beer and, you know, people would be moshing to.
Yeah.
They were
moshing all the way to the snack counter.
It was moshing all over the place. It was really scary.
The best thing he said was like, all I know is he dressed like an asshole.
I'm only giving you this for free. Subscribe to the Patreon.
But he had Benza had a nice story kind of defending Trent Reznor from accusations and
yeah.
Manson had kind of set up. It's a show worth listening to this week. He's not always worth listening to, but that was actually a pretty good show this
yeah,
week.
Yeah, it was interesting because Benza's usually a guy who's going to say that the women are liars, but he said he knows enough about Manson to think that it's absolutely true. And he also said that Manson claimed that he and Reznor got a girl drunk and had sex with her and in his book. And he said he knew enough. He told a story about Reznor where he goes, I don't think that's true because this is how he behaved when, you know, in this circumstance.
And that story is worth listening to. That gives you a different perspective on Trent Reznor that you might otherwise not have. You know,
yeah, I've always thought of Trent Reznor as a sleazebag, and it kind of changed the way I thought about him when I heard that.
Yeah. I still don't care for his music since like 1996 or so.
At the last,
he released The Fragile or whatever the hell it was called.
I liked With Teeth a lot. The album
With Teeth?
Yeah, I thought that was a great record.
I don't think I've heard it. I probably just wasn't in a hurry because he bored me.
I think it's great. Everything he's done since then, I could throw in the trash. You know.
Check it out on the fucking Spotify.
Yeah, with
those dudes.
Nine Inch Nails With Teeth. It might be my favorite record of theirs. I love that album.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's got the Mr. the Mike Portnoy of grunge. I think Dave Grohl plays drums on it.
Oh really?
Yeah. Foo Fighters have a new album out.
Really? I totally forgot they existed.
Yeah. Medicine at Midnight just came out on Friday.
Okay. Might be another more listenable power pop disguised as metal.
You know what band's new album, they do the same thing every time, I thought the new one was awesome, was Accept's Too Mean to Die.
Oh, really?
Yeah, super good. Oh, man. Just
Hunter, you and your new music. You and your vinyl buying ways.
I didn't buy this one on vinyl. I didn't want to buy that one on vinyl because they were
asking. To hear that in your car.
Yeah, I wanted to listen to my car.
Yeah.
Wanted to hear it in my car.
That's what you want to hear for your little, your commute to work.
Yeah. Yeah, when I listen to AM radio in my car, the only thing you can hear on AM radio is right-wing talk. And by
right-wing and college football games and sometimes high school football games. That's about it.
I remember my uncle, when he got in my car, he's like, oh, you got a CD player? And I said, yeah. And he goes, these days, this was back when I was in high school. He goes, everybody says, do you have a CD player? He goes, when I was in high school, it was, does it have FM radio?
Yes.
Yeah. The CDs are better. You can play them in your car.
You can. Yeah. Play them in your car.
Yeah.
Pretty soon, though, you won't be able to. It's just Bluetooth,
Yeah, okay. No. I had a – I know exactly. Yeah, of course. I had a Ford Fiesta until it got completely totaled. That did not come with a CD player.
Interesting.
And that was 2015. And then I got a Toyota Corolla. And that also did not come with a CD player.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy hell.
Yeah.
Wow.
If it was an Adam Carolla, it would have come with some Graham Parker,
Yeah. Play some CDs. Play some John Hyatt.
Yeah, I don't want to listen to First Wave. They only play the crap 80s music.
Five.
I don't like XM radio. The 80s station only plays crap. They don't play Graham Parker.
Yeah,
or Nick Lowe.
He's not really a Gen Xer. He's not a boomer. There's some sort of in between.
Corolla is a very specific type of person because he's not Gen X. He's not boomer.
His mom's a commie.
You know what? I think he's the same type of being that Andrew Breitbart was, because Andrew Breitbart liked all that stuff too, music wise.
Yeah, it's some sort of weird – it's something in that generation when they were born, like, that's what they heard in college or in
– they heard Morrissey
after high school.
Yeah.
Right. They just kind of took it a different way because Breitbart had weird taste.
Yeah, he did. He loved all the, kind of 80s alternative stuff, like Morrissey and the Smiths and the Cure and, whatever else.
Right. It's a kind of weird generation thing. I don't feel connected to them at all. I don't understand them.
I don't understand them either, but but I like Morrissey. Morrissey's
all right. And I like the Smiths. The Smiths are okay, but they wouldn't be my favorites.
No.
And Morrissey wouldn't be my favorite singer, but I saw Morrissey live a couple of years back. I thought he was great.
No, I only listen to Goldfinger and Less Than Jake. That's all I listen to. I don't listen to anything else.
That's the Tony Hawk in you.
Yeah. And the Ernies. I only listen to the Ernies.
Do you listen to Voodoo Glow Skulls?
Yes, absolutely, with their Dragon Ball Z album art cover. That was the...
Yeah, blast jocks from hell while you're bench pressing.
If you don't have a horn section, get out. I don't care.
You got to have that semi-ska stuff, man.
Well, what you need to do is have them all record in the same room on mono.
Operation Ivy is your edgy listen, underground.
Yeah, oh yeah. I got to have that Ground Zero California punk, Bay Area
right.
Punk. The band everybody else picked up from, The Offspring, whatever else.
Yeah, my tastes were always messed up. I was either 10 years behind or 10 years ahead of everybody with music. So
my White album is Hitler Bad, Vandals Good.
John,
yeah.
And Hunter, actually, do you think if you were born in, I don't know, let's say not even one generation prior, but two generations prior, would you be contrarian and want to go back to, a generation prior to that or two generations prior to that? Or would you like... the music that you like now?
Huh.
That's a good question.
I I think if you're born in an era where, because if you talk to guys from that time, they'll say, oh, there was, you could realistically go to the record store 1 week and there'd be a new one by the Beatles, a new one by the Stones, and a new one by the Who, and maybe a new one by the Animals. It was just kind of mind-boggling. And you think, I don't know, if I was overexposed to it when I was young, would I like it as much? I'm not so sure.
Right. Would you find yourself wanting, would you go try to listen to like ragtime or something? You know?
Yeah, would I go grab some Glenn Miller singles? Who knows? Possibly. Right. I might have some more partiality to it because I'm not overexposed to it. Like one thing that I really got into when I was a teenager buying records and cassettes, because cassettes were the big thing to buy at the time. I tended to drift towards buying stuff that was not played on MTV and not played on my rock stations. With the exception of bands like The Cult, because I'd hear that and I'd go, okay, that's exceptional. I really like hearing that. But I didn't really care about to own on CD or, excuse me, cassette and record what I could just see on MTV every hour. Because MTV had a playlist. They just played the same 10 videos over and over again all day.
Mm-hmm. Considering that there was only three channels and the Ed Sullivan Show was just, whatever that was. I guess that was weekly or once a day during the week. Would somebody like the Beatles be overexposed? Even I know we had Beatlemania and all that, but would they be overexposed back in 1964?
My dad never liked the Beatles. He liked Motown. So, and I don't know if Motown was the rebellious thing to listen to that year, but he was not, he didn't seem like a Beatles. I don't think he ever really liked them.
Well, your dad.
And some people say he would have been 14, and some people have said that the Beatles were like a boy band, like girls loved them.
Right.
So I'm not so sure. It's like, I wonder how much is revisionist history that we see in rock documentaries and such.
Right. I just, considering that there was less outlets, I don't know how anybody could be overexposed.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, and I don't know because you'll hear about kids who were listening to Wolfman Jack on the X radio on the Mexican border. So who knows? And back then, you could tune in channels from New York and Chicago like overnight. Like the signals were stronger at nighttime, and you'll hear stories from people saying, "Oh yeah, I used to." They live in the Midwest, but they could tune in Long John Neville in New York with his all-night kind of proto Art Bell type show. So it's hard to – it's a weird thing because I don't know. Would you hear Link Ray as sort of an alternative or something on the radio or Dick Dale? I don't know.
That's
surf
what I
rock.
Would, that's what would be curious to me. And you can't get any kind of honest remembrances of any of that, because I think the boomer pop culture has just like inundated us, and it's just I feel like you can't, we would have heard about that stuff at this point.
Yeah,
and nobody's really either telling the truth about it or they forgot.
Yeah, they rewrite history quite a bit. Yeah.
They
like
do.
There's people who I know people who saw Jimi Hendrix live, and and I heard from one guy who said, oh, he walked out halfway through the concert because Jimmy was messed up on drugs and wasn't playing very well. He was boring. I remember people seeing Stevie Ray Vaughan being disappointed by what they were getting because he was kind of screwed up and it was just kind of noodling and it was boring people. So but then after they're dead, oh my God, the greatest ever, God on earth. Maybe it didn't seem to be that way back then.
Yeah,
it's the Bruce Lee story.
Oh man, that's
it really
truth.
Is. Oh geez, I've gotten even more stuff about the real opinion of Bruce Lee back in the 60s. It's like I see it all the time, because certain people start talking who nobody ever talked to before, and you get a different point of view. So it's hard to imagine. I don't know if I would have been some jerk talking about how great Big Band was and the Beatles sucked. Who knows?
Oh, I'm sure there was somebody, some individual,
Oh, yeah. There was some weirdo who wanted to get into fist fights. And who knows? Or, it might have been girls like the Beatles or they like the Beach Boys, but guys like the Stones. I could see that. And if you wanted to be edgy, you said you like the Pretty Things, who nobody could hear on the radio back then,
Right. I just haven't run into anybody that's been willing to admit that.
No, that's an interesting.
Right, or the Yardbirds, or you know, Muddy Waters, or.
I think there's a hidden history there that needs to be uncovered.
Well, soon it's just going to be too late.
Yeah. Very soon. No, yeah, you gotta get the boomers while they're still alive.
Yeah.
But you know, and it's interesting. I've met like one or two boomers that still listen to new music, but the rest, it's like, you know, after the 70s. You know,
yeah,
they just stop. It's like a mental thing. They don't move on.
Yeah,
they stop at Boz Scaggs and Pablo Cruz, and they end up right there.
It's one of the few things I can't blame them for, really.
No. Yeah. Well, and I know some Gen X guys who talk about how horrible the 80s were, and the few boomers that listen to new music, they've told me that they love the 70s. The 80s was like a dark time, and that the 90s, the grunge stuff, was like the return to like rock that they really enjoyed, that it was oh, good music's back.
Nice of you to bring me up without naming me Hunter.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to you know, name anybody, but
I think I'm baffled by the love of 80s music that I see from people my age and stuff.
I think he also called you a boomer too.
Yeah.
I don't think John's a boomer.
I keep finding gray hairs in my hair. It's like, this is a sign. Yeah, it's just like, I'll see people talk about how great the 80s were, and it's like, I don't want to hear REM ever again.
You know what? The 80s, they get better and better with each passing new year.
Synthesizers and English guys wearing makeup.
You know, I used to not care, and the past like 6 years, it's really hit me home. It's like, you know what? It wasn't that bad.
Well, the 90s are very forgettable, and that's what happens.
Yeah, that decade is the only decade of the 20th century that had no identity at all.
You're right.
Yeah.
So I was saying, somebody had asked me before, and I said Nirvana was a right place, right time type of band.
Yeah, they were. Their music wasn't particularly original. It just, that was the most radio friendly version.
It hit right at the right time when no one cared what Slaughter and Enough is Enough is releasing.
Yeah. You know, it just, people were sick of that 80s hair stuff.
Yeah, and it's like the stuff I do like from the 80s is the more underground things, like, you know, a lot of the punk rock. I like the early hip hop, like a lot of that stuff. I like the reggae bands like Black Uhuru. I love them, but that's about all I really love about the 80s.
Mm. Yeah.
It's not the mainstream stuff. I don't want to hear Duran Duran again.
Well, and like when a lot of the great bands from the 70s, like you listen to their stuff from the 70s and then you play something from the '80s, and it's like, oh, like, you know, listen to
yeah,
a cheap,
oh god,
like Cheap Trick. Listen to a Cheap Trick '70s album, then listen to an '80s one, and you're gonna go, what the hell happened? You know,
Blondie stops at 101.
Blondie, Heart, yeah. Heart. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So
Scorpions.
Scorpion. Oh Scorpions, yeah.
Scorpions were amazing in the 70s, and in the 80s, even though they were huge with the mullet heads, I did not like them.
Yeah, the Scorpions in the 70s, they're one of the great unsung 70s rock bands, but in the 80s, they as Michael Schenker said in an interview, when Uli John Roth was in the Scorpions, they were 70s rock band. When Matthias Jabs joined the Scorpions, they were 80s rock band.
Yeah, perfectly. Perfectly stated.
Yeah. Sums it up perfectly, I think. All right. Well, we're way off from Phil Spector, so you guys want to go ahead and rate this one?
We're talking about music.
Yeah, we're talking about music. True.
Just not Wall of Sound.
Not Wall of Sound.
Eric's question of, like, would you be rebellious or contrarian in the 60s if you were around then? I don't know. It's got you thinking. It's got me thinking, you know.
I don't know. I was not like when I was a teenager, you know, I didn't really seek out those sort of narratives, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say.
Well, you didn't have to because they were selling to your economy like crazy. So.
Yeah. I mean, I liked, you know, some of the pop punk stuff and that mm-hmm. time. I liked some of the metal stuff, but you know, I didn't think of it as fitting into a larger narrative, if that makes sense.
Right.
I just like some of the stuff that was coming out and some of the stuff that was coming out I didn't like, you know.
Yeah, I think we're just saying this stuff now because let's face it, rock music is pretty much dead as a mainstream thing. The album is dead as sort of a mainstream thing.
We've kind of come full circle because, the song was sold as the single ages ago, and then the album became the commodity. And now that we're streaming, it's all about the song again.
Yeah. So a new Phil Spector type of genius could make it big again because it's all about the single.
But like, I think you're, even though she's been vocally resistant to the Spotify business model, the CEO of Spotify was like, "You want to make more money, make more music." You know, that was his. That's something he said. And
he's not wrong.
And the thing is, yeah, obviously from where he's sitting, it's beneficial for him, but he's correct. And how many records has Taylor Swift put out in the past year? Like 3 or 4? I mean, she's the biggest name in music, and she's been cranking out records like every few months. So, you know, but she's putting out full albums. I think it's like we're putting out as much music as we can.
Right.
Just to get as much action on streaming platforms as possible.
Yeah, and, well, Kiss used to put out an album every year.
They used to put out several albums a year, you know.
Yeah, they were consistent, you know.
And Van Halen,
Kiss albums
on a
year.
You know, Van Halen used to put out several albums a year, and then it became like one album every 20 years. You know?
Right. And they made money. That was the problem.
yeah, exactly.
And that was Spotify. I had to slow them down.
So, I mean, the business is changing, but it's kind of funny. We're kind of coming around to this full circle where you're going to see bands putting out music at a stronger clip instead of doing a record and touring it for 3 years, four years, you know, putting out 2 records a decade. You're going to start seeing them crank out more albums if they want to survive. They're going to just put out a lot of albums, chuck them onto streaming, and you know, do maybe a boutique batch for the vinyl crowd, the physical crowd.
All right. Well, the odd thing I'm finding as I get older, and almost get boomer-esque in my taste, I got an HD radio put in my car. And I recommend getting one if you get a chance or if you got the money to burn. Which I had that week. Mm-hmm. And there is a station playing classic country, and it's not Johnny Cash, George Jones, classic country. It's actually like early 80s pop country. But the funny thing is I'm finding that I love it. Like, I like hearing it because it's the type of stuff I would hear on the radio when I was a little kid, you know, because my mom would have it on that station. And it's like it's far better constructed than a lot of singles music today or rock music today or whatever. It's got that kind of pop polish or whatever when they start bringing it into country music, but it sounds pretty good.
Give us some artists.
You might hear a Barbara Mandrell song that you would find very corny and silly on 8-track, and you hear it on an HD radio and it's like, I don't know, it's a pretty good pop tune. I mean, it's done with a country twang, but it works. You know,
that might be the nostalgia talking on your end if you were listening.
It could be. It very well could be. But like, I heard some Ronnie Millsap and I said, damn, this is pretty good. I kind of thought he was a cheesy, you know, pop country guy. But I heard some of his early stuff and it didn't sound bad at all. I was really surprised. And they'll play like the Waylon Jennings tunes from that time and Willie Nelson stuff that, you know, didn't sound like the early 70s outlaw country era.
I don't know if you remember having this conversation with me because I think it's been over a year now. But Hunter, John and I were discussing that for the past slightly over a decade, we've had the same A-list artists in the music industry that are, for instance, 2009, we had Lady Gaga, Beyonce, and we were just talking about Taylor Swift. They're still big, and they're still just big. They're still just as big. There's nobody else that's new. Somebody can maybe argue Billie
Eilish. Yeah, I was going to say she might be up there. Lorde was one that almost, but no, you know?
But those three ladies that I mentioned are still just as big as they were 11, almost 12 years ago now. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in most of the history of music, you're big for 2, maybe 3 years.
Yeah.
And you can keep making music, but you're not going to be in the same, you know, platform that you were before. You could even say that about Elvis.
Yeah, you could say that about Britney Spears, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, Britney Spears was huge for about a little longer than most, I think, about 5 years or so, 6.
Christina Aguilera.
Christina Aguilera didn't have the longevity that Britney had. Yeah. By the time, I guess, Britney went crazy in 06, 07, whenever that happened, I think after that she never recovered.
She's been a Vegas mainstay for a while. Yeah.
If she had remained stable, she'd probably still be a big name.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but I mean, what's different? Why aren't we getting new people? I don't know.
I think our culture is kind of stuck right now.
Yeah.
We don't get new big artists. Our movies are stuck. You know, we don't. There's nothing new under the sun with film. It seems like all of our culture is kind of stuck. You know, we're not getting the new hot artist. We're not getting the new hot filmmaker. We're not getting the new hot music video, you know, whatever. I mean, I think the only place where anything happens maybe is video games, you know? I mean.
Yeah. Everything else, we seem to be in this, like, Cotard syndrome or something.
Yeah, it feels like we're stuck as a culture.
We're dead. You know, we just died.
And I think, you know, some people might say, well, it's COVID. I think it's been before that.
It was totally before that. It was totally before that. We would have already.
I've been feeling that way long before the coof, you know.
Yes. I think that our culture is kind of stuck. I don't know what it is, if it's that we have a group of people who maybe are interested in keeping the status quo, or if it's we have I kind of wonder about our creative industries, if they're even capable of producing outside of small random examples that are, you know, almost glitches in the matrix, if they're even capable of producing stuff that's not just regurgitations of the same schlock we keep making today. I don't know.
Even fashion. Think about fashion.
Yeah.
Do people dress any differently 20 years later? No, they don't.
No.
Everybody's wearing the same stuff.
We don't have, you know, where, you know, you walk in a place and go, oh, that's 80s. Oh, that's 90s. Oh, that's 40s, 20s, teens.
Yeah.
It seems like culture kind of stopped in the aughts. And it's been sort of stuck since then. I don't know if it's the internet, you know, if it's not having we kind of have a monomedia, but it's sort of going insane and dying right now.
Yeah.
Could
be the internet, could be antidepressants. It could be, maybe that's stifling creativity. I don't know.
And it could just be that maybe everything's so democratized that we have everything in its little ghettos right now. Like, you know, people, they go watch their favorite YouTube channel. They go watch their favorite streamer. They have their bands they like on Bandcamp.
It's the same thing with television. That I've never heard of.
I remember Bret Easton Ellis saying on his podcast, he goes, you know, you used to have the water cooler TV. This was years ago. He said this. It was like 5 years ago. He goes, or 4 years ago, he said, you had, you know, the shows people would talk about at the water cooler at work. He said, now it's, I hear people coming up to me and singing the praises of TV shows I've never heard of.
Yeah.
That never used to happen. Like, I'd hear about a show and go, okay. And then somebody come up to me and go, oh, you got to watch it. He goes, people come up to me and go, have you seen, you know, Ozark? And I'm like, what's that? You know, or something, you know, whatever show it is, you know, it's like, there's so much content out there that there's none of it can really make an impact on the culture.
It's too diversified.
Yeah.
There's too much to appeal to different little fringe groups.
And it's so easy to make...
Nothing would be mainstream.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a film now. It's so easy to make a album. It's so easy to produce content that could have something to do with it. You know, a lot of people, they don't watch TV. They watch live streams. They watch YouTube channels.
To them, PewDiePie is funnier than some sitcom they could watch on network television.
And they're not wrong.
The ads. No, they're not wrong at all.
You know, there's a lot of people, talented people, who produce content for nothing. And, you know, like Eric and I, whenever James Rolfe drops a new video or a new AVGN, we're like, oh, what'd you think? Oh, yeah, we talked about this. You know, he did a video on Dragon Quest the other day, and Eric and I were talking about that and how that's what he's good at and is doing stuff like that. And
he should stay away from, he should stay away from Charlie Chan. That's what he should say.
Yeah, he should know no business talking about it.
He's the guy who did that video, right?
Yes.
The video of forgotten series is programmers and things. It's just like, if you're not going to do the research, then don't talk about it. It's embarrassing.
And it felt to me like, cause he's a guy who strikes me as completely apolitical,
right.
Completely like a political atheist, like a true political atheist, not like a Mike McPadden political atheist, you know, right. He's a true political atheist. I think that him saying something like that is just an example of how ingrained all that stuff is in the culture now. You know,
it's part of the conversation. Like, you have to say that, prefacing any discussion of Charlie Chan movies. We're going to have to review one on here to debunk a lot of that.
That's a good idea.
For those that don't know what we're talking about, because we didn't really set that up, it's James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, did a video. It's about 10, 15 minutes long, whatever it is, on forgotten old movie series, like sequels and what have you, and he got to Charlie Chan. It was the last one he covered, and he said that he admitted that he hadn't seen even one entry.
So he shouldn't have even been talking about it.
Yeah, and then said that, oh, but I read a Wikipedia article, and obviously there was some stereotypical and it was racist, so maybe that was for the best that I didn't watch it. Like, what? You didn't watch it?
Yeah.
And he's a guy, I remember thinking he was smarter than most because he did a video talking about how I'm not going to go see the new Ghostbusters movie.
Right. No, but I think you're absolutely right that it's just permeated the culture so much that...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, he said that I'm not going to see the new Ghostbusters movie. And he was... If it had been anyone else, he would have been canceled. But the mob came after him, and he just didn't respond. He just acted as though it never happened.
That's what you should always
and
do.
And I remember thinking, that's the playbook right there, is James Rolfe, when he did the Ghostbusters video, he said, I'm not going to see the new Ghostbusters movie because I think it's attacking the fans, and I'm a fan, and I don't want to see it. And everybody was like, I remember I saw people I knew who were normies attacking him on the internet and on Facebook and whatever else. There were all these memes. What did he respond to it? Crickets. Said nothing. Just made his next video as though nothing happened. And everybody backed down. Nobody did anything.
I wish he was in charge of CineState.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All CineState had to do was wait two measly weeks, and the mob would have gone for the whole Fentanyl Floyd situation, and they would have forgotten all about what happened. In fact, I think that was 2016, right? The female Ghostbusters.
Yes.
That video probably reinvigorated sort of a lagging, I could be wrong about that. I just felt that way about James at the time, that he hadn't been really moving the meter. And that kind of reinvigorated eyeballs on his channel.
Yeah, absolutely. I started seeing his face everywhere on the internet after that. But he did not address it ever. And I think, I think that was, you know, everybody can learn from that. Just, you know, don't apologize. Don't, you know, a lot of this stuff, it's just going to go away if you just don't do anything. And especially a guy who's self-employed like he is, you know, he didn't use any, and there was no danger of YouTube taking down his channel because there was nothing really to point to. He didn't say he hates women or anything like that.
Well, nowadays, I wonder.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though, is you get all these YouTubers who are like, oh, I haven't gotten taken down because I follow the terms of service. Well, the terms of service are mean nothing. It's just where we can change them and take you down. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't. Terms of service mean nothing. You know, it just, it's a matter of did we decide to change? If they can change it and take you out, that's it.
Didn't they try to take down PewDiePie and then the reaction was so bad they flinched and then signed him to like a, you know, crazy $100 million deal?
I don't know. I remember they took away some deals he had with Disney and YouTube partnership, but I don't know. I mean, he's obviously not been hurt too much by it because he's still very influential. So, I don't know.
Well, he got signed to like an exclusive with them for a few million or like 10 million, 20 million, whatever the hell they could afford. Like he became their first guy signed to like $1 million deal. So he'd be exclusive to them because they realized how much they got hurt when they killed a deal of his or pulled his videos. I can't remember what happened.
I didn't follow up, but yeah, that could be. But you know who got canceled permanently was Phil Spector.
Yes. He did him and his crazy hair.
He was canceled and he canceled himself.
Yeah, Guillermo would tell you that wig was more atrocious than his murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That was sadder than when his father got kidnapped.
What a much loser. Oh my goodness. I can't believe worse. You said.
Much worse. All right, guys, let's rate Phil Spector by David Mamet. What would you give it, Eric? Yes goes first.
Oh, it's a 5.
5. Oof, ouch.
Yeah, it didn't move me either way. I didn't hate it, didn't like it. Yeah,
well, that's the perfect rating for that, you know, it's middle of the road.
Yeah.
John, what about you?
4.5, pretty much, based on the Pacino performance is about the only reason to sit through it.
I'll go
the Rare Bird, the good Pacino performance.
Yeah, I give it a 7 out of 10. I enjoyed it a lot more this time around. And I think it's a late period Al Pacino performance that's worth seeing. I think Helen Mirren's quite good in it too. And I think the Mamet dialogue kind of cracks and pops a little bit. You know, I enjoyed it. It does kind of, I think the film lacks a climax. That's the thing that I think hurts it the most. It just kind of
ends. It just ends.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, it ends, yeah. That's
like
all.
you don't really expect it to end when it does. Cause it doesn't feel like it has a third act.
It barely qualifies as a movie. It feels like a Netflix film or something.
It really does. It feels like a TV movie. Like you guys said. But the stuff in it that I think is entertaining, I thought was highly entertaining and highly memorable. So I like that about it.
I rewatched Glengarry Glen Ross.
Mm.
And I noticed that the Alec Baldwin scene, he is doing Trump better than he's been doing Trump the past 4 years on SNL.
Yes, I agree. It's a really good observation.
Yeah. Trump was a big deal back then, even in the 80s, long before he had the game show, contrary to what people like to present as a narrative nowadays. I wouldn't doubt that it was probably based on something Trump had presented.
Well, the mannerisms, the inflection in the voice, not the voice itself. I don't know. Right. Just, it struck me as that.
Struck me as very alpha New York guy stuff.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well... Eric, is there anything you want to plug right now?
Go to my channel on YouTube, Eric Zaldivar. I got nothing new, but rewatch all the videos again if you haven't already. It's all video essays that I do. Yeah, I do. Sometimes there's some goofery as well.
I watch them every time you upload one. I'm like, oh, watching that. It's good stuff.
Thank you.
Anyway, John, anything you want to add before we go?
Be sure to listen to Stuart's kind of mini episodes he's been dropping between our regular shows.
Yes.
They're worth checking out.
I really enjoyed the Friday the 13th box set episode he did. I hope that was good.
Yeah. Does that come with the uncut? Like, did they go back? Did they find? Is all that footage gone? Like the later sequels where the MPA would rip all that stuff out?
I think they got some of it, but it. I think the early films have more stuff in them. The later films, I think they. I don't know. Go listen to the episode and find out.
I will.
Because Stuart kind of went into them. I have the set, but I haven't really ripped into it. I got my replacement discs, but I haven't really taken the time to sit down and go through it because it's there is a lot of there's like hours and hours and hours of extras and all kinds of stuff on there and remasters and all of that.
Or Stu could drop the extra 4 seconds that are in the new Psycho Blu-ray without even having to research it. So
yeah,
like he knows those movies so well.
Yeah.
You should do a video on the Psycho sequels. A show on the Psycho sequels are very good.
Yeah, I've always heard that those are stronger than you'd think.
We've also been pushed maybe on doing the Amityville series because I didn't realize there's like a million Amityville sequels.
Vinegar have me on for the sleazy Italian one, the second one.
Vinegar Syndrome just put out a ton of those really low budget ones.
Really?
Yeah.
Vinegar Syndrome.
Yep.
Vinegar Syndrome, of course. They're pornographic already. So. Yeah. Damiano Damiani, director of everybody's favorite spaghetti western, Bullet for the General. Everybody loves that one,
yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, with that, I think we're just going to go ahead and say adios.
I'll say that's about all. Peace out.
Good night.
All right.